Support for KMUW's Into Music podcast comes from McClelland, reminding listeners that Frank Sinatra coined the word skibbity in Strangers in the Night, which you can listen to in their downtown Wichita showroom. More info on McClelland's innovative sound, lighting, and video technology can be found at maxsound.com.
Hi, I'm Jed Budwin, and you're listening to Into Music from the KMUW studios, part of the NPR Podcast Network. My guest on this episode is Glenn Phillips of Toad the Wet Sprocket. The band's new album, Rings, the Acoustic Sessions, is out January 30th and features acoustic renditions of songs such as Good Intentions, Fall Down, and Nancy. Phillips recently spoke with me about the band's current approach to live performance, the goodwill they've built with their fan base over 40 years, and the power and beauty of grief. That's Glenn Phillips of Toad the Wet Sprocket on Into Music, coming up now. I have to tell you that I saw Toad the Wet Sprocket for the first time ever last year in Salina, Kansas, with Bare Naked Ladies, and when you walked off stage and the lights went up, I just wanted to start shouting, like, four more hours.
Thank you.
And I was curious about that because the live performance was just, like, so enjoyable and kind of life-affirming and joyous. And was that something that was always present when Toad played live, or did that take time to build to?
Well, I think we had it and we lost it and we got it back. And I'll actually give some credit specifically to Bare Naked Ladies for that. We'd done a tour with them a couple of years ago. And I think we saw in them the kind of culture we could have if we worked at it. And saw the other band we were playing with, like a culture that we'd had for a long time and nobody particularly enjoyed. And we're like, this is a choice. This is a choice, and we all have to make it. And I think, you know, we've always been lucky to have hired great crew, had great people around us. But the band, you know, we've been together since high school, and there was just stuff that wasn't being let go of and reactions that were just locked into years and years of resentment. And I think we all independently made that decision to let it go, and as a band made the decision of like, let's make this good. We're stuck with each other, you know. It's kind of like with family, you know you can have the, you know, the bashing of heads between people, and at some point it just doesn't serve anything. It's like more trouble than it's worth, and hopefully people make the decision to just move on and have it be better. And anyway, we did that. So in the last few years, it's like, you know, we've been smiling at each other on stage and, you know, working harder to buoy each other up than to put each other down. But it was definitely not always like that.
Yeah, because that's the kind of thing, right, that ultimately the audience, I think, can pick up on. And it's like, well, if they're having a good time, and I feel good seeing that, I want more of that, I'm going to come back.
Yeah. Interestingly, there has been a, I don't think, coincidental uptick in attendance since we got our attitude better.
I was also struck, David Lowery put out this kind of autobiographical album this year. And one of the things that he addresses is kind of the height of Cracker's fame and how he didn't really deal with that well, you know. Mm-hmm. And then he looks back on it and he says, you know, if I would have known then, that summer that we were on top of the world, that was going to be it, I would have fallen to my I would have fallen to my knees and thanked God, you know, in that moment.
Yeah. I understand that completely. The lack of gratitude and the lack of understanding for how absolutely quickly everything can be taken away from you, you know. We went from platinum selling to, when I was 27, I had two kids. I could not get a record deal at any label. Unemployed, unsignable, family to take care of, 27 years old. I'd seen the peak of my career at 25. And I was just not prepared psychologically, monetarily, none of it. It messed with my head. So, yeah. Oh, well.
But along the way, you have the songs, and this collection demonstrates, I think, that core of material. What was the kind of thinking about doing this acoustic record at this point?
I mean, part of it was we're about to be 40 as a band. We've been doing this a long ass time. So we were turning 40. We've been inserting this, little acoustic subset. It was another thing we stole from Bare Naked Ladies was the little acoustic subset. But we've been really enjoying it. It was a highlight of the set. And that when we had taken the song Good Intentions, and honestly, it was as a joke, I think I started playing it like bluegrass and everybody joined in. We're like, that's cool. Like, so it gave us this idea. I mean, some of the songs on the acoustic album are pretty straightforward. Like All I Want is not that far from the original in terms of the arrangement. But some of them, like Good Intentions, like Rings, like Jam, really take, really reinterpret the original. And with some, I mean, you know, the song Rings, that was always this like fast backbeat track, is now a piano ballad. And it's like, that's what the song, the song finally makes sense to me. We'd always tried to play that song live, always loved the song, but never felt like it worked. And like the reinterpretation, just, we all love it again. So I don't know. It was the anniversary. And so that idea of like, let's get together, let's do some acoustic songs. And it ended up being definitely a more ambitious project. I think I'd envisioned it initially as something where we're playing it live, making, you know, and really not a studio project, not these larger arrangements. And it turned into what it is. And I think I fought it for a minute, but the end result, I think, is great. And I love Robert Stevenson's mixes on it are really interesting and not what you'd expect, I think, for, you know, he does like Queens of the Stone Age. And so it has an interestingly, it's not a Nashville acoustic record. It's got its own kind of gnarlier vibe to it. So, yeah.
Yeah, that was one of the things I wondered about was like, you know, you've lived with a lot of these songs for a period of time, but that thing of like finding sometimes like the song within the song, oh, this is, when I wrote this, I couldn't have imagined this. And playing it all these years, I couldn't have imagined it. So it sounds like that happened.
Yeah. And that's the best, you know, new old stock.
So, I mean, you couldn't have envisioned, right, when you were writing many of these tunes years and years ago, the kind of longevity. Nobody can kind of predict that. So what has it felt like when it's like, okay, maybe a song's, you know, on the CMJ charts or something, you know, 1994, it falls away, but dang it, 1998, people are still listening to it.
We're definitely not of, I think the Pixies are like the Big Lebowski. We're probably more like Repo Man or something, you know, you know, didn't do so great. Did okay at the box office, did okay at the box office, but really lived as you know, a cult rental classic. But, you know, I love that our audience has stayed with us. I think part of it is that, you know, I've said before that we weren't writing songs about being 16 and getting girls, so they age better. We were writing songs about wondering, you know, if society's going to fall apart or what happens when you die. And so that, you know, those last as you get older, and great. And you still don't know the answers. So I think the songs luckily aged well. And I think the relationship that we built with our fans, where we weren't good at doing the rock star, like larger than life thing. We made ourselves very accessible. We're a bunch of nerds, you know, we're a bunch of neurodivergent nerds. And so like and so we speak to our people, and it's, you know, I think, and we were nerds, you know, Patton Oswalt actually gave us credit for this in one, he was talking about, you know, that it used to not be easy to be a nerd. You know, you couldn't order anything online. You had to go find the shit in real life. And you'd get beat up for it. I loved it. He pointed out, like, I mean, Toad the Wet Sprocket, they named that after a Monty Python sketch. Like, that's deep cut nerd. And so, you know, I think we spoke to those people before nerds, you know, started running the world and turning into fascists. You know, it's a different era. And there's, you know, I think also worked really hard to keep those relationships going, you know, until, I don't know, 12 years ago or so, I used to, you know, stay out and talk to the last person who was waiting at the bus. And we did that all through the big years. We would stay out there and spend 2 extra hours just hanging out in the parking lot and talking to everybody. And, you know, those authentic interactions, I think, just add up over time. And I think there was a trust in there, you know. And 12 years ago, I was in the middle of a divorce and I started having panic attacks after the shows. So I just started protecting myself and going to bed instead of hanging out because I couldn't do it anymore. And my sleep is terrible as a middle-aged person. So in any event, yeah, it makes me really happy and I'm proud of it because I think it took a lot of effort on our part to build those relationships. And it also, you know, it's reciprocal. Like our audience has been really good to us, really loyal, really kind, always willing to listen to the new records, you know, always willing to take in a new song. So we're really grateful.
Yeah. I mean, so I'm curious about, you know, when you start off and you're not writing about, you know, cruising the, I don't know, whatever the strip would have been in your hometown, but we had one in mind.
State Street.
Okay. You know, you're not writing about that. You're writing about these other things.
Although I will say, I don't want to take it. Nerf Herder did have Down on Haley, which is the other strip. And that's a great fucking song.
Yeah.
Just going to say.
I mean, there is room for that. But having a body of work or a themes to approach, that kind of thing, that's really important for writers, right? To find out what they're going to sing about, what they're going to draw from. Mm-hmm. And sometimes it is, you know, chasing girls on the main strip or whatever.
Yeah. But I was a weird, I mean, as a teenager, I was, I still am, I don't know, I kind of pretentious and maudlin. And so I was, you know, I mean, some of the stuff I look at now, but it's true, like, that when I was, you know, 19, like, I was reading, it was part of the beauty of that time. It's hard to explain to, like, people growing up now how much books meant and how much time we spent, like, just reading or being outside. You were never in that, like, half awake scrolling mode. And I spend hours there. Like, it's awful. It's the worst drug, you know. It does nothing for you and just keeps you there. But man, that those times where, you know, 19 and I'm spending, you know, I'm reading a lot of literary fiction, but I was also, like, reading all the Eileen Pagels books on, you know, or, you know, Dead Sea Scrolls, was really wanting to learn about, like, as a person who didn't grow up with Christianity, I was curious about early Christian history. And so, like, how did they reach the point of the Nicene Creed? And what were the books that were thrown out? And what was the original? And, you know, and that was maybe not every 19-year-old at that age, but I think far more common to, you know, be filling your mind with, you know, history and ideas instead of, you know, the constant endless feed of the iPhone. And so, you know, it was a rich environment. And so all that stuff made it into songs, you know.
Right. Well, there is that thing when you hit a certain age, you have the stuff that you're being exposed to in school. And maybe some of that's inspiring, but then you start hearing about other things, whether it's through older friends or just reading, and you get really turned on and you start chasing it. And it becomes this thing that, I don't know, for me, has been just a lifelong pursuit. It's like, okay, what's next?
Well, I mean, part of, I think, the ease of acquiring, you know, low quality information right now is that we get drawn to stuff. It's kind of like if you think every, you know, as a teenage boy, if you think every beautiful girl is also interesting and captivating and all these other things, and you just kind of go from surface appearance to surface appearance. And it's so easy to jump from shiny tidbit to shiny tidbit. Even with music, we have all the world's music at our fingertips. And so you can listen. And I do these things too. I'm not making an accusation. This is a confession, right? It's, you know, you can listen on the surface to everything. And a few things will grab you a little more. And so you may go deeper. But it used to be like you had the radio and then you would go to the record store. And if you bought a record that you didn't get, you would keep listening to it until you got it. If you got the new record by your favorite band and you're like, I don't know, this feels like a step back, you'd still keep listening to it because you bought it. You put your hard-earned money into it and you were invested in understanding it. So you listen to less music, but you listened with far more depth. And I think the same with information, right? You know, vetting your sources, choosing, understanding, especially, you know, for instance, if you're reading about early Christianity, it's pretty easy to tell the difference between like an Eileen Pagel scholarly work and like, you know, Dead Sea Scrolls deception, where it's all, you know, crazy conspiracy. You can tell who's done their homework and who's making shit up. And you can be attracted to one more than another. That's fine. And you can like pop music, you can like, you know, but it's, I miss that era of having less input, but having to go deeper into everything, having to figure out what made something work or not work. And I think that can still happen. Like the McGee record, like Two Star and the Dream Police, I've listened to that more than I've listened to anything in years. I'm just fascinated by it, warts and all. It's such an odd record and it's so compelling. And, you know, that happens rarely, or Madison Cunningham stuff really grabs me. Or, you know, you can have as well when there's just a narrative. There's this great Fela Kuti documentary podcast right now called Fear No Man. It's by Jad Abumrad from Radiolab. And it's like 9 episodes, and it's only getting up midway through his life. But Fela, whoa, like I'd known about him and known of him. And so I've been like deep diving into that stuff recently, which is just a whole different world of music. And so, you know, it still happens. I don't even know what you asked. I'm just ranting now. I'll stop and let you ask something else.
Well, but I mean, you touch on that thing. Like when you had a limited number of records, right? Like I remember the day that I went to the mall with my paycheck and I bought the Replacements, Let It Be, and Jackson Browne's The Pretender. And I wore those tapes transparent, right? And I knew every bass lick. And if I didn't know it, if there was something I heard that was new, that too was exciting after 9 months of listening to it.
I don't know anything new half that well. I mean, quite honestly, like those records I had, they were my life, you know? And new records, I know people who can still listen in that deep way. It's one of the things I'm trying to get back in my life is like my attention. And I think it's, you know, back to ADHD or something. Like, as somebody who's easily distractible, as somebody who's overwhelmed easily, to have so much input available and to have so much coming at you all the time, to actively try to filter that out and to even not have FOMO, right? To go like, I'm going to miss some great stuff. I'm sure of that. Every once in a while, I'm really grateful to have missed great stuff because somebody can come drop a, you know, I mean, I was I'm a late 20s, but like I remember when my dad died, I hadn't really noticed. I'd heard I short people and I love LA, but I didn't know Randy Newman. And when I was 27, I remember hearing Old Man and discovering like the entire catalog of Randy Newman, and my life changed. It was like, he's like Kurt Vonnegut, but in music, you know, he blew my doors off. And so there's the occasional thing you get like the late access to, but I'd rather listen to less music and listen deeper. The buffet, it's nice for variety's sake, but you know, it's not like composing a really good meal, you know?
Yeah. I mean, imagine if we could do that with books, right? Like, I mean, I have a number of books, but I have like those five that I'll revisit like annually or semi-annually, or just pick up sometimes and just look at a couple of passages, you know?
It's rewarding. And God, I mean, that a book can, you know, I remember The Overstory by Richard Powers, like that took me 2 weeks to recover from. Just, it was the most, it was like a family member had died. Like it hit me so deeply. And I don't think a work of art can hit you that deeply unless you invest something into it. It's the thing about a novel. You're giving it dozens of hours. You're giving it so much attention, especially if you're reading like before you go to bed, you're dream processing all of this. You're taking these scenes in and chewing them over subconsciously, and they're deepening your perception about the world. I mean, Richard Powers talks about that, like, you know, telling people facts, they're not, doesn't tend to sway people, but a story can change the world. That's his thing. And it can be used for good or ill. I mean, if you look at RFK and Trump, they have told stories. You know, there is a thing right now where storytelling has been overtaken by people with poor informational systems and I think some pretty bad, intention. But they've got the story way better than the scientists and those who are working for an equitable society have. The people working for an equitable society, if they don't eloquently share the beauty of what they're trying to do. And unfortunately, people who are trying to tear that down and make a less equitable society, a less kind society, a less livable or fair society, those people have managed to create around their aims something that sounds almost utopian. And, reality eventually catches up. I think it's doing that. But man, story means so much.
I know we're talking about Toad, but I want to, if I can, ask you about a solo song of yours. Nobody's going to get hurt. And I thought that was such a beautiful song. I still think it's a beautiful song. And I love the fact that what you're doing there is the taking lies, right? And, you know, was that like a, did you have that as like an exercise, or was that just like, how did you do that? How did you arrive at that place?
Pretty much. I had a little help on that one, but I wrote that with Lori McKenna. And she's mostly a country writer. She lives out in Boston. I was on tour and I've known her for a while and went over to her house. And literally I walked in saying, I want a song that's all lies. It's called Nobody's Gonna Get Hurt. And it took us about 2 hours to put it together. But you were correct. That was absolutely the concept. It was very straightforward. I was in the middle of breaks up, still kind of my post-divorce, just, tsunami of emotion and change and, kids growing up and moving out and just this idea, like, I think I was, inspired in part by people who would, like, it's like, I'm going through a really hard time. Everything's going to be okay. You'll be fine. Everything's, and, I'd been doing a lot of study of grief, and even that, people, you'll be fine. You'll get over it. Everything's okay. Some stuff you don't get over. I'm still not over my father dying. I'm going to miss him forever. I'm going to grieve him forever. That's not a problem. I still grieve the breakup of my marriage and my family. To not grieve, I have moved forward. I've, decided to say yes to more. I decide to still value whatever shape that family that I did have takes and love my kids even. But that idea that everything, nobody's going to get hurt, everything's going to be okay, is just a lie. And so I felt it was a good idea to have fun with that. And I mean, it starts with a very Laurie McKenna domesticity, it's the dishes and the laundry and the kids. And we fanned it out where the, what I love about that song is that the lies become sweeter and, more vague. I'll always, I'll never leave your side. I won't let you down. I'm not going to, what is it? I'll never leave your side. I won't lose myself to fear or lose you to my pride. Like all these pretty lies, you're not going to keep. And just increasingly devastating. We did change one line because originally it was the highway wasn't made for leaving. Whiskey wasn't made for regret. Country song. She's like, we need whiskey if it's a country song. The smoke in my lungs makes it easier to breathe. And I wanted it to be on the last one, and our best days haven't happened yet. And she was like, let's stick with broken hearts will always mend. Like, best days haven't happened. That's too, some of it's, her argument was like, there's like, hey, life's going to be hard. You might not get what you want, but let's not go all the way to the hope. Like, that was too hopeless. So we took that one out. But thank you. I love that song.
As you're talking about grief, I'm thinking about, people I know who have lost somebody, and everybody kind of says, are they going to be okay? When is this going to kind of lift? And the thing is, it's like maybe they lost their son or their daughter or their husband, wife, whatever. And I would be more worried if it just dissipated really easily from them, because somehow it's like if you miss somebody like for that period of time, there's something very normal and human about that ultimately.
Yeah. Post-divorce, I was looking at divorce literature and it wasn't really helping me. And so I started looking at grief literature, which is much more often focused on bereavement, I have, two friends here in Santa Barbara, Mike and Stacy McCrory, and they lead grief retreats. They're son took his life, and they are going to be dealing with that pain their entire lives. And they don't want to stop feeling. It's like there's the thing of David White described it once as like grief is, this is paraphrasing him, but grief is, love plus change. It's the inevitable result of loving things that change. Because everything you love, whether it dies, whether it grows, right? He gives the example, all your kids have to do to break your heart is to grow up happy and healthy and leave you into their wonderful lives. Like, nothing wrong there. But there's something about when we love something deeply, there's a part of us that never wants it to change. And it always will. And sometimes in ways that are so sudden and tragic that it just breaks a part of us. And I don't, you know, and people move, I think, with different rates of speed through their grief. There's no one speed to handle it. And sometimes I think it's too soon. It can be too soon for a very long time to get under the hood of it and examine it. But I think as well, you know, the when I've led song in like grief retreats and grief ceremonies, the emphasis on those is, I think part of it is simply for people to not just understand that they're not alone in their grief, but to internalize it, to feel it, to actually like know it experientially, that everyone carries a heavy load. Everyone grieves. Everyone is losing something or afraid of losing something, you know? And I think that work, I think, lets people understand that they don't have to give up their grief, their love. I think a lot of people, there's a feeling that if you stop grieving openly, if you stop feeling that pain and having that pain on the top, that you're somehow disrespecting what you've lost. And I think when people start to heal in whatever kind of work they're doing with their grief, because our society is pretty much useless in providing those tools easily. And some churches offer that, some communities offer that. There's, you know, there are resources for people, but you have to go find them. It's not like the washerwomen just come in and hold you and sing the songs of the, you know, we don't live in an intact indigenous society. So we have to kind of come up with our versions of that. But I think people, when they have that experience, they realize that they can feel just as deeply, love just as deeply, and also still feel joy and honor and respect the people they've lost by living more fully, right? That, you know, in the same way, I just saw this great documentary on Andrea Gibson, the poet, that's on Netflix. I'm forgetting the name of it, but they died last July, I want to say, of cancer. And this documentary is both about their poetry, but also their cancer, their death, preparing for leaving the planet. And there is something about that I have noticed with my friends who have a cancer diagnosis, where they often both simultaneously fight for their life, but also start to see every minute as precious, start to have this, like, I wasn't, right? That thing of, I wasn't alive until I started knowing I was dying, right? And I think we can reach that as well by losing those around us, and that we get, once we stop hurting from it, some of that same lift of, I'm gonna live, you know, for me, with my dad, who was the person who gave me the gift of curiosity and awe, you know, I think of him every time I fall in love with something new and beautiful in the world. And every time I learn something, I feel him. And my way of grieving him is to live for him in that way. And like, I get to honor him every time I'm in awe, which is a pretty great way to honor somebody. And so I think we find our paths to those. But yeah, I love the subject of grief. To me, it's like one of the most beautiful things about being a human being is how much it hurts to love. You know? Like, kind of, if you're not in grief, like, whether it's for the people you've lost, or that we can't be more kind to each other, that we've chosen to create a world that is so cruel and feckless and power hungry. You know, so many things to feel grief about. But the counter to that, I always remember, you do not grieve what you do not love, you know? And it's tells you what you care about.
You've been listening to a conversation with Glenn Phillips of Toad the Wet Sprocket. The band's new album, Rings, the Acoustic Sessions, is out January 30th. You can learn more about the band and see their upcoming tour dates with Men at Work and Shonen Knife at toadthewetsprocket.com. For more on Glenn Phillips and his solo work, including concert dates, visit glennphillips.com. You can learn more about this podcast and all programming on our station at kmuw.org. We welcome your questions and comments at info@kmuw.org. And as always, want to remind you that our theme music is composed and performed by Torn Anderson. Thanks for listening. We'll see you next time.